We regulate defense medical experts and their lies. We're damn good too. But you can't be any geek off the street. You gotta be handy with the cross-exam if you know what I mean. Earn your keep. Regulators! Mount up. It was a litigation fight. A fully packed room, Kev Dog is here to crush. Ready to entomb some defense MD. His opinion's all junk, he knows he can't hide. Scared to the bone, just hit the west side of Hermosa Beach. Defense about to learn, wrath of SLG. Send the Army report, opinions all weak. All you insurance doc hacks are about to see. So I took the report and went right through it. I grabbed the mic and said, let's do this. You seen the MRIs and said nothing's up. Yet I know lying is how you make your bucks. This doc is a sleaze and also a perv. Straight face at the disc, never hit the nerve. Forget the treating docs, this a classic trick. Paid to say the disc is normal and shouldn't be fixed. I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I need to expose this crooked doctor's wealth. Insurance every time, surely the next. Paid millions to lie about injuries of either sex. My client's diagnosed, doc's acting a clown. Says it's all a sprain and lose a few pounds. Claims no nerve compression when doc was around. Even though the pain radiates all the way down. Doc says it's in his head, some out-of-form sound. Even through the Mullinger theory down. This theory won't fly, let me contemplate. My client got the surgery and now it feels great. The pain went away, that's the ultimate goal. All Doc could do now was cry placebo. Now Doc's red and yelling, it's a tad bit late. Kev Dog and SLP had to regulate. No evidence of that, it's going real swell.
To the next episode.
KC3927 Eggshell.
Love it. That's awesome.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Justice Team Podcast. That was probably, if you were listening to that song, I hope you didn't skip our intro song, because that was our own Kevin O'Hara with a great rendition of Regulators. It was awesome.
Very nice.
Awesome. Bravo. I would pay for that MP3 download for sure.
I think he wrote that after a 3-day bender too.
Oh yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Even more impressive.
So welcome to the Justice Team Podcast. This episode is workers' comp PI crossover cases. It's a pretty interesting topic, probably a topic a lot of people are misinformed about. So we'll get into that in a second. We'll talk about our speakers. But first, we have our cocktail from the regulator himself, Kevin O'Hara, Kev Dog, a.k.a. Kevin, what do you got for us today, brother?
I got a bit of an interesting one. It's called Apple of My IPA. We've got some Booze and Al Cavados cognac, some cinnamon syrup that I made myself, some fresh lemon juice, St. Elizabeth Allspice Dram, and I top it all off with some IPA. I chose a Jai-Alai IPA because I like that one.
So I think it's a soft J. Jai-Alai, maybe.
Jai-Alai?
Yeah.
Perhaps that's the way.
You want to pass these around?
Yeah, let's pass these around.
All right.
Awesome. You know, instead of that cinnamon syrup, maybe you can add some of the cinnamon fireball.
Geraldine brought the fireball. She's a big fan of Pitbull, right?
Yeah. I am. Thank Who isn't, though?
Yeah. And for those of you Thank who you. See the no sleep till justice sign, that is actually Kevin came up with that. That's his tagline, so to speak. So I guess he gets to take that sign with him if he ever tries to leave us. I guess he gets first rights to that sign.
Well, no sleep till justice.
Thank you, Kevin.
Right. Cheers.
No sleep till justice.
Cheers. Awesome.
Oh, very good.
Wow, that is really good.
All right, so we got workers' comp PI crossover cases. The reason we wanted to do this is kind of, it's a topic that I think a lot of PI attorneys don't really understand, and I think they're sitting on gold mines and they don't even know it. But we'll get into it. First, let me introduce the speakers. We have two special guests here today. To my left is Geraldine Lee. Geraldine, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us what you do, where you do it, and you can self-promote a little bit. Tell us about how awesome you are.
I hate doing that, by the way.
Sure you do. Yeah, no, I attorneys do. Love no, talking about themselves.
So I've been an attorney for 25 years in California, and I specialize in workers' comp and personal injury and civil litigation. Recently, I've done a lot of the personal injury work comp crossover cases because most of my friends are you guys. So you've got the personal injury cases, and there's always a work comp component to it. So I'm pretty active in the work comp world, and just recently helped Assemblyperson Eloise Reyes change some laws in the state of California governing work comp and injured workers. Nice. So,
Golf club.
A consumer advocate, not just an attorney. Thank you, Geraldine, for making the trek from Yorba Linda.
Actually, Santa Ana.
Oh, Santa Ana. Okay, yeah.
It's kind of far. Hit a couple of lights. Takes about 5 minutes.
And to my right is Adam Super Savin. Adam, same deal. Tell us a little about yourself, what you do, where you do it, and why you're here, I guess.
Well, I had to drive 2 hours to get here, and
It's a privilege.
You're here for the drink.
It's such a privilege, and I got to say, there's more singing talent at Simon Law Group than any other firm in this country, guaranteed. It's just such an honor to be
here. That was a representation by Adam Savin, not the Simon Law Group.
That's true. So I started off my career doing workers' compensation with my father and my mom and their practice, and I basically really wanted to do personal injury and started doing more and more personal injury. And because we have such a large workers' comp practice, most of my personal injury cases are these third-party crossover cases that come from workers' comp. And that's where I built my initial nest egg of cases, was going through all the workers' comp files, looking for third-party cases. And it's just kind of been what I do. At least 50% of our cases are probably third-party crossovers at this point.
And for those of you who don't follow Adam or his firm on social media, he, like us, is very into comic books. If you come to our office, you'll see all these Marvel, you know, paintings and statues. We have a big Groot statue here. Adam's more the DC guy, huh? You got the Superman cufflinks on today.
I got Superman cufflinks on today, but I also have some Marvel character tattoos. Mm. So I don't discriminate.
Oh, you do? What do you have?
So far, I have Wolverine,
Oh,
Deadpool,
you're a big Punisher guy too, aren't you?
And Iron Man. And
awesome.
I'm working on working on more.
Sweet.
I'll give you the name of another tattoo artist who does a lot of that. After.
But I like the heroes. DC or Marvel.
Oh, cool. And then to my right, we have Justice Team member Grayson Goody. I always call him our resident hybrid. He does everything. What do you call it? Jack of all trades, master of none?
It's exactly what I am. Jack of all trades, master of none.
Now, so Grayson, the reason he's on this panel, we at the Simon Law Group don't do a ton of workers' comp, but we do have some crossover cases, and Grayson has litigated some of those, and he's actually tried one. So he'll be able to provide us some insight on how it works at trial, what you can use to your advantage. And then to my left is my fellow law and motion nerd, Travis Davis.
Yeah, so I run the law and motion department here at the Simon Law Group. I've been doing that for about 2 years. And I try cases every once in a while. I just had one with my buddy Sevi, which was successful. So, good job. Great.
All right, so let's dive into it. Geraldine. Can you give us just kind of a basic, we say workers' comp PI crossover, what are we talking about?
So it's any case where the person who's injured is within the course and scope of employment. And there's so many different scenarios that come up, and I'm sure Adam can share some examples. But most commonly, it's someone who's traveling for their work, right? So you've got to drive to a meeting that's off-site, and you get rear-ended by another vehicle. That's really most common. I've had people that have to travel. They've opened the compartment of an airplane and luggage falls on them. So you've got a personal injury claim against Southwest or JetBlue, and then you also have a workers' comp case. And then you have slip and falls, right? And you've got, you know, a wax company that's putting on the wrong kind of wax, and then the nurse falls on it. So those are the typical type of crossover cases.
And we'll get into it a little bit more later. You know, are there distinct benefits to these types of cases that maybe you wouldn't get with a normal personal injury case?
Yes. You know, a lot of times with personal injury cases, right, you know, attorneys don't know how to spot these out, or do we even want to spot them out? So you do. I mean, first of all, on a professional ethical standard, you do have to find out if your client has any other types of cases, employment, work comp. And then if you do, you know, they should pursue some work comp benefits, because immediately you get medical treatment, you get temporary disability benefits. Now, I bring that up. Temporary disability benefits, it's almost like filing for EDD, right? You get disabled, you trip on the curb, even if it's not work comp, you can file for EDD. However, if your injured worker, let's say, is illegal, they can't file for ADD, right? Or maybe they don't have a, you know, valid Social Security. They can still get temporary disability benefits. So while they're off of work, they still get paid. And then you get some other benefits from it as well.
Right, and that's 2 years, up to 2 years of payments. So a big problem you see in these PI cases are that our clients have no money.
That's right.
The catastrophic cases, they go 1 year, 2 years, and us as firms, we're either finding funding companies or we're paying ourselves to help support them. But workers' comp can be paying them 2/3 of their income up to a maximum. I mean, it's about almost $5,000 a month, but they can get paid for 2 years while you litigate the PI case.
And it's a no-fault system, right?
That's right.
So there's not really much of a fight to get those benefits, right?
The only thing we would have to prove is that it is an injury that occurs on the job or as a result of employment. We call it AOE COB. So that's right. The only thing we have to prove.
So Adam, I'll throw the ball over to you. You know, I hear a lot the term exclusive remedy. You know, I think a lot of times attorneys see a workers' comp lien or somebody's hurt while they're at work, and they automatically assume there's no PI case here. There's a workers' comp involved. Yeah. I don't even need to take this case. You should talk to a workers' comp lawyer. So I think a lot of attorneys are probably sitting on big cases or pass on cases, not even knowing what they have. So, you know, tell us a little bit about what you should be doing when somebody comes to you and says, hey, I got hurt at work. Tell us what the exclusive remedy is, and is there ways around that?
Right. It's a very common question I see even on listserv. People post a scenario and say, exclusive remedy, yes or no, and they don't know what to do. And what the exclusive remedy is, it basically just says that your only remedy against your employer is workers' compensation without a couple exceptions. It just says you can't sue your employer if you're a covered employee. It has nothing to do with any third party, with any other contractor, any other driver. And we see sometimes even defense attorneys saying, you can't sue us because this is an exclusive remedy. And that's a benefit for the employer, not for any other third party. And we get cases. I've had multiple seven-figure settlements in cases that PI attorneys thought it was just a workers' comp.
That's right.
And they're just not looking for it. And we get a lot of construction cases, and it happens a lot in construction. They'll find out that a construction worker fell from scaffolding. For example, scaffolding collapses, and they go to see a lawyer, and they say, I fell from scaffolding. I have workers' comp insurance. And they say, we're not interested, exclusive remedy. I get the case because they come to our office for workers' comp. I look at it, and I say, who's your contractor that you work for? And they say, whatever contractor. And I say, and who put up the scaffolding? And they say, oh, somebody else.
That's right.
And I say, okay, well, that's the third party, and let's go after, you know, significant damages.
So, yeah, a good rule of thumb, somebody comes to you and says, hey, I got hurt at work. Make sure you explore how they got hurt. Is there some sort of third party issue there? Because you could be sitting on a big case and not even and pass on it and not even take advantage of it.
So can I add some? Adam brings up a good point, because when, as work comp practitioners, right, when I'm doing the intake, I'll often ask all these questions, right? You know, do you work for the company that put up the scaffolding? Who put up the scaffolding? Well, who's in charge? Was there a safety person? Because then if, let's say you know, personal injury attorney had referred it to me, I'll send it back over to the personal injury attorney and go, hey, you've got to explore this issue because, you know, the injured worker isn't the one who put up the scaffolding, and the scaffolding company didn't have control of it. It was the safety manager or safety company that came out and did that.
And Geraldine, it's true that even if the person at fault is the employer, there's certain instances where the exclusive remedy would not apply, correct?
Even if the employer is at fault?
If the employer is the only entity at fault. So serious and willful.
Yes.
Right. How about the instance where the employer doesn't carry workers' comp?
Right. Exactly. And, you know, I think Adam and I were talking about that, but if the employer does not have workers' comp insurance, then you don't have to stay within the workers' compensation realm. You can actually sue them outside of workers' comp. And there's a civil case right there, and it's negligence per se because they didn't have workers' comp insurance.
So that kind of brings me up to an area of law that I want to explore, because this was a case that that we started taking early on that we didn't even realize you can do this. Because again, we hear people hurt at work, exclusive remedy. And Adam actually, I think it was your father who dealt with this case where a day laborer sort of situation where they didn't have workers' comp insurance.
That wasn't really a UEF case. That was more or less, can an employee working for like a homeowner, for example, can they file under workers' compensation? Are they considered an employee under the statute? And is the homeowner required to have workers' compensation insurance? So basically what that rule basically is the scheme of workers' comp doesn't want you to have to, as a homeowner, cover your gardener, your pool guy, people who come once a week for an hour a week. But what they do want you to do is if you have somebody working on your house, and the threshold is they have to work at least 52 hours within a 90-day period and make a certain amount of money, which is not that much. I think it's
$100.
It's $100, yeah. Or it could be $500 within like a 90-day period. There's a couple weird things. Then they are considered a statutory employee of the homeowner, and the homeowner's policy has to apply. And most homeowners' policies do have workers' comp. So it just means that you have to pursue the case under workers' comp, and your exclusive remedy against the homeowners through workers' comp.
Right. So, Travis, you happen to know that labor code section off the top of your head? It's like 3,700 something
series. I have some research on it.
Travis did a lot of research last night.
I certainly did.
After Gus went to bed, right?
Exactly.
On the exclusive remedy or the...
So the situation where...
3351 subsection D.
Yeah, so the situation where you... somebody hires, let's say, the context it happens with in a lot of our cases that we have is somebody hires a day laborer, usually an immigrant, to come and work on their apartment complex, right? And they're doing tree trimming and they fall and break their back. Technically, that should be what you're saying is a workers' comp case, right?
If they fulfill that 52 hours mm-hmm. within a 90-day period. So what happens, which is a very common question, is somebody falls from a tree 20 feet up, they're on the third day working, they don't meet the threshold, but the homeowner hires an unlicensed contractor, and this person falls and has catastrophic injuries. What you're going to see is the workers' comp carrier, the homeowner's insurance, saying, we don't cover. They put their hands up saying, he's not an employee, you're SOL, sorry.
The independent contractor, right?
Right, but then...
And Adam, before you go on, you said unlicensed contractor. What does that have to do with anything, whether he's licensed or unlicensed?
It has a lot to do with it, okay?
I'm glad you asked.
Because if the person is licensed, they're an independent contractor. There's a labor code and business professions code that says if your job requires a license and you don't have one, you're presumed an employee and not an independent contractor, right? So if this tree trimmer falls and he's a licensed arborist, that homeowner can be clear and free unless there's independent negligence. But if that tree trimmer falls and they have no insurance and they're not licensed, then that homeowner is a statutory employer. Mm-hmm. And even if they don't fulfill the 52-hour rule and they're not covered under the scheme of workers' comp as a defined employee, that homeowner is still liable for if they're negligent. So you can still go after the homeowner, the condominium owner, or whatever.
Could I talk about exclusive remedy really fast?
Sure.
And it also is related to the crossover cases. So often it is an exclusive remedy. You know, you get injured and you can only go after the employer. But let's say during a medical treatment or surgery, something goes wrong. Right. So you've got a crossover case in a med mal, because now if the doctor has messed up during surgery, now you can go outside the exclusive remedy. Well, I'm sorry, you're still can't sue the employer, but now you've got a crossover case and it's a med mal case against the doctor, the hospital, the nurses, or whomever had, committed the negligence during the medical treatment.
And Adam and Grayson, even if you can answer this question, what's the benefit of these cases, right? Isn't there there's a presumption, right? Once you get to trial, there's implications that there's a rebuttable, the burden is now on them to prove that they're not an employer, right?
Right. So there's multiple presumptions in workers' comp that are great. You know, when you have an uninsured employer, you get a presumption of negligence, shifts the burden. If there's any violation of any code or regulation like an OSHA violation. You also get negligence per se. But what's even better than all that is they lose the defense of comparative fault, which is huge. So you can have a tree trimmer and they're going to say, well, he didn't wear a helmet. He wasn't wearing a rope. He shouldn't have been doing all that. Well, you don't get that defense.
What do you mean by a we get the presumption, but it's rebuttable?
Right. So if you're going to sue an employer civilly for being uninsured, you get a presumption, but it is a rebuttable presumption of negligence. So you still have to show some nexus of negligence. But think about how difficult that burden is to overcome for the defense. They are now on the, you know, they're having to prove that they weren't negligent. And you can say it's so easy to prove negligence against them. You know, they should have had the right safeguards. They should have done this. There's always somebody gets hurt at work. There's always something you can say. So it is a rebuttable presumption. If there's no code violations, you don't get negligence per se, but rarely are they going to be able to rebut that presumption of negligence.
So we might spend a little bit more time on the specific cases, punch presses, yeah. Day laborers, that sort of thing, uninsured, or UEF, you call it. Yeah. But I want to jump ahead a little bit, and I want to talk about whenever you have, you're suing a third party for negligence, but there's also an allegation of of employer negligence. So for you, Adam and Grayson, you guys tried a case together where somebody slipped and fell at work, right? So what happens when you get to trial and there's an allegation from, you know, you represent the plaintiff, Grayson, let's say, and she slipped and fell at work, hurt her back. She sued the janitorial company for mopping when they shouldn't have been mopping or having signs up. And then the janitorial company turns around and cross complaints against her employer. How does that play at trial? Is that something you can use to your advantage? Did you use it to your advantage?
Yeah, absolutely. So Adam and I had a case a few years back, and that's exactly what happened. It was a slip and fall case, and the third party janitorial company actually at trial decided that they were going to try to blame the employer. So in that situation, the employer can field a defense, get experts, and essentially you can team up with the employer. You each have the same theory of the case, et cetera, et cetera. But in the case that Adam and I tried, they tried to allege that, but the first time they did that was at trial, and we had asked in discovery if they blamed anybody else, and they didn't put it in discovery, so we were able to motion and eliminate that out, and that was a non-issue at trial, which actually I think helped us.
Yeah, I'll throw that over to Travis, actually, because this is kind of a law in motion. He and I nerd out on this type of thing all the time, and we've actually talked about it in prior podcasts, but when there is, I think Grayson's referring to a specific form interrogatory, the contention interrogatory series. If that so what in that situation, what do they have to do, and how do you use that to your advantage to get them to not be able to bring that defense at trial?
So what you want to do is send some written discovery out, form interrogatories. You want to check 15.1 and also the 16 series. So 15.1 is going to ask them for all documents, witnesses, facts regarding their affirmative defenses, which is their burden of proof. Any affirmative defense is their burden. And then 16 is more specific about contentions of who else other than defendant or plaintiff, you know, may have caused the injuries. And it goes into more detail there. And so what you want to do is send that out. And a lot of times defense will just kind of give a blanket objection and say that this was asserted so as to not waive the right to assert this defense. And then you want to follow up. You want to send supplemental discovery, maybe ask it at a PMK depot or something like that. And if they don't present these facts to you, then pre-trial you can bring a motion in limine to exclude that defense because it wasn't proven in the litigation.
So what happened in that case?
Well, real quick, just to piggyback, it's actually even better in these workers' comp cases because the labor code actually requires that defense has to be on a pleading filed with the court, which is usually their answer, where they have to have an affirmative defense of Whit v. Jackson. If they don't do that, they don't get to bring it up. So in our slip and fall case that me and Grayson did, it ended up being 100% against the janitorial company at trial. No comparative on the plaintiff, no comparative on the employer. We kept the employer out.
So they couldn't 100%. Even argue comparative?
They couldn't. Well, they could argue comparative, but not against the employer.
Gotcha.
Adam, you mentioned Witt v. Jackson. There's a Witt equation. Can you explain what that is?
It gets a little tricky, but basically it's the no double dipping rule. And it depends on whether there's employer negligence or not. So let's just say that there was no employer negligence for the sake of this calculation, and workers' comp had paid $100,000 in benefits that the employee received, and you go to trial and you get a verdict for $1 million. Then the defense can do a post-trial motion called Witt v. Jackson motion, and they would only have to pay $900,000 instead of $1 million because they get credit for that $100,000. So what you can do, though, is you can buy that lien, that $100,000 lien, and maybe you pay $30,000 for it. So even though they still get their same $100,000 credit, the plaintiff got credit for $100,000 of benefits and only had to pay $30,000 for it.
And so with that formula, if the employer is, you know, a certain percentage negligent, then you have to deduct that, right? So now let's cross it over into work comp. So in that example, let's say the client gets $900,000 as a net. So now I, in the work comp case, have to fight a $900,000, well, then there's attorney's fees, but let's just assume that it's $900,000 that they get in their pocket. So now as a credit issue in the work comp case, I have to battle $900,000, which means the injured worker doesn't get one penny of medical benefits or any sort of permanent disability or anything, transportation, reimbursement for mileage, nothing, until they can show they have spent $900,000, right? And you're going to ask, well, part of that $900,000 is pain and suffering, right? Of course. You get that in the PI or in a civil case. You don't get that in a workers' comp case. However, the laws are so tight within the labor code and in workers' comp that there's no account for pain and suffering. It's $900,000 that you have to flat out take a credit on, and you have to prove your client has spent it. And we have ways we can fight the credit.
Yeah, I want to get into liens and credit. Oh, sorry.
I just want to explore one more part of that. So you can actually use that, correct me if I'm wrong, to your benefit in the civil side of things. Say they have a judgment or a verdict, and it's split up between economic damages and non-economic damages. Mm-hmm. You can use the fact that your workers' comp lien is only for economic damages and use that the ratio on the verdict to break down the amount of the lien even further, correct?
Currently, no.
On the civil side.
Oh, on the civil side.
Right. So So defense only gets the credit for the ratio that is for economic damages.
Right. All right, go ahead.
So there's a difference between the lien and the credit.
Correct.
Okay.
So I want before we jump into liens and credits, because that's a whole other separate issue that PI attorneys makes their heads explode a little bit, because I don't even understand it. But before we jump into that, I want to just a couple more things about when you're trying these cases, these crossover cases, and the implications of workers' comp and insurance and stuff. So one of the questions I have, and I don't know that how the best way to address this, so maybe you guys could help me out, is workers' comp is a little different. You have, you know, in the PI world, you have your expert, right? You retain an expert, they retain an expert. In the workers' comp world, you have QME and AME. You agree on an independent doctor, almost like an arbitrator or a mediator. So when that gets to trial in the PI case and you have a QME doctor and their opinions, how does that come into evidence in the PI case? And what do you call that doctor? Because you don't want to let the jury know that there's workers' comp insurance. So how do you sanitize that issue without saying this person, this doctor, he's not our doctor, he's not their doctor, he's just the employer's doctor? How do you do it?
And I think it would also depend on whether the QME doctor gave you a good report or a bad report.
Because if they give you a bad report as a plaintiff, you're not going to want to say, this is my treating doctor, right?
Exactly.
Right. And that goes to the early framing of the case. If you have a good third-party case, you're going to contact the defense in the work comp and say, hey, let me get the right doctors don't put any roadblocks up, and I'm going to make sure you guys get paid back your lien, and you'll take a credit, and we get to pick the right doctors. But going back to your question, in the case that me and Grayson did, the all we used were the doctors that treated in the workers' comp, and we brought a SCOE orthopedic surgeon to trial, and we brought a pain management doctor.
And did you call – but were they QMEs or were they treating doctors?
We just called them treating physicians.
That's right.
And it went a long way, and they did a great job for us at trial. And the best part is it's the same doctors, the same guys you take as experts in these PI cases are the same doctors that are experts in the workers' comp cases.
So what I do often is I work with the personal injury attorney from the beginning, right? Because I want to help you with our mutual client. So for instance, in one of the cases that I just did, we use Gerald Alexander. You guys know Gerald Alexander, right? But I chose him as the AME in our case. I got the defense to agree to that. And I said, hey, let's use Gerald Alexander. And, you know, he is a good expert, you know, for personal injury and civil cases as well. And so you, the civil attorney just listed Gerald Alexander as a non-retained expert, right? And then you get his reports.
And you get a free expert. You get the record review. Yep. And that's what's so important with working with the workers' comp attorney early on and getting a game plan. Because if we know what to do for the third party and we're helping you guys, then we can work a deal with the defense attorney to give us the right expert so they don't just try to our case.
Because you convince them that there is a subrogation action for their client. So it's in their best interest to work with us on the work comp side so that we can all sit on the same side of the table in the civil case. And, you know, we all get paid back depending on policy limits. And that's another issue.
So you just don't get much pushback as long as you work with the defense attorney on the same on getting that QME doctor, the AME doctor that you can use in the civil case.
That's right.
Sometimes you don't get any pushback.
Yeah. So for instance, I've got an electrocution case right now, and the employer is actually really helping us out because they know that there is a general contractor that is on the property. And we know that that general contractor didn't contact Edison to turn off the wires, the electrical lines, before my guy's doing the gutter work, right? And so the gutter hits the electrical lines, he's zapped. And the employer is actually out there interviewing witnesses for us, right? Talking to all their employees. I'm like, thank you. Because now I'm just handing all that over to the personal injury attorney and saying, look, because they want to go after, you know, for their money as well. But they also don't want a serious and willful, which you were talking about, where, you know, we can file an additional claim in our workers' comp case, which actually is quasi-civil. And you get additional money for the client and the work comp case on more of a negligence standard.
So a couple more questions about trial implications and how workers' comp interplays, but and then we'll switch and talk more about credits and liens and stuff that makes my head hurt a little
That's
bit.
That's like a 3-hour podcast.
Right, we'll try the best we can. But and I want to kick it over to our PI, you know, exclusive PI people, Travis and Grayson. The whole issue of workers' comp evidence or just existence of workers' comp insurance coming in to the personal injury trial, because, well, I'll let you kind of guys just take it. Can you bring that up? Are they allowed to argue that they should have treated their workers' comp to mitigate damages, that sort of thing?
Sure. So you start with there's a jury instruction regarding insurance 105, but then there's one more specifically about workers' comp that says that you cannot take into account workers' compensation insurance in calculating damages, right? And I think this also interplays with the recent case of Pebley, which we're graced with one of the trial attorneys here. But generally, Pebley stands for the proposition that an insured plaintiff that chooses to treat outside of his or her insurance is treated as uninsured for purposes of trial. And what that does, and that coupled with 352, which would exclude evidence that they're even insured in the first place, essentially that means that defense can't use the fact that they had insurance to argue that they could have mitigated their damages for treating through that insurance rather than through a lien.
And I
which
imagine
generally is higher.
Yeah, and I imagine the same thing would occur with work comp, because the thrust behind Pebley was that if you treat through your HMO or through Kaiser, you may not get the right doctors, you might not get immediate treatment, you might not get the best treatment. And if you look at, you know, work comp treatment, you kind of have a similar issue there. You're only going to be able to see certain doctors. You got to jump through some hoops sometimes. So I imagine that's going to be the same exact thing at trial.
Certainly. And I think, you know, I actually, I found a case. I love this. It was in Bermudez, which came before Pebley. And I think it really helps bolster the idea that Pebley, the proposition in it, does not apply just strictly to health insurance, and certainly not just strictly to Kaiser. And this is from Bermudez. It says, Howell certainly did not suggest uninsured plaintiffs are limited in their measure of recovery to the typical amount incurred by an insured plaintiff. Right, so we know that. And then it goes on to say, or for that matter, the typical amount incurred by any other category of plaintiff. So I think you can take this idea here and apply that certainly to workers' compensation. Because I think that the policy behind Pebley is certainly at play in workers' comp. Like Grayson mentioned, you choose to treat on a lien because it's efficient and it's the best care around, right? And sometimes you don't get that in the work comp
for
arena.
Sure.
But, you know, you can't be afraid to have workers' comp come into your trials.
Yes.
And I've done trial both ways. And I actually did a trial where we had workers' comp sitting at the table with us as an intervener, and they got to do their whole line of questions and cross-examinations.
Does the jury know that they this is insurance?
Yeah. It was State Compensation Insurance Fund. Mm-hmm. And they had a lawyer there, and they got to do their own voir dire and bring their own witnesses. And I put the adjuster right on the stand, and I said, what's the procedure to get all this treatment done? It goes through this doctor. They do a request, utilization review, independent medical review. Then you have an AME. Mm-hmm. And I said, so it goes through like five doctors before you guys authorize this surgery, correct? Mm-hmm. Correct. And you paid all this stuff. And I think you can explain the way we argued the case at the end was, look, folks, all the medical bills and treatment, I'm not asking. State fund is asking for that money back. We're only asking for the pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. And, I think it could be very compelling in the right case.
I agree. I mean, you know, right now I'm involved where I'm the plaintiff attorney and there is a work comp subro. And, you know, I'm just kind of sitting back and letting him take the lead because the lien is huge, right? And he's incentivized to get his money back for his client's money back. And so, you know, he's really running with it. He's trying to get experts. Can we talk about lien doctors for a second? Because as Adam was talking about, you know, the doctors in workers' comp, it were really limited. And sometimes on these list of doctors that are available to treat the clients, it's called a medical provider network, you know, you've got really just like B minus C plus types of doctors. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times they don't even authorize treatment with different specialists. Like a neuropsych is no longer on the list of doctors that treat in a workers' comp case. You can't even get a PQME, a qualified medical examiner in that area. So often working with the personal injury civil attorney, I'll say, hey, you know, there's a neurologist in my case that says he needs a neuropsych, but I can't get it. So you guys go get in on a lien, right? And then in my report, it does say, you know, he needs a neuropsych. And so then you go and get that on a lien.
And by the way, when you guys build up your experts in the PI case and you get these great reports that are very favorable to our clients, send them to the workers' comp attorney because they could send those reports to the AME and the defense on the workers' comp doesn't have anything even close to it. And then you get the AMEs and the workers' comp on your side and agreeing with your experts.
And by the way, the liens, you know, the medical bills in a work comp case, they pay it at almost like Medi-Cal rates. It's very.
It doesn't
very
sound like reasonable and customary to me.
Definitely not.
Right? Medi-Cal rates, right, Adam?
It's like Medi-Cal plus 10%. Yeah. But,
well, and Geraldine, you made some really good points there. It doesn't start and stop with work comp and HMOs. It goes all the way up and down the line of insurances. It goes up to PPOs and even the best insurance. Some doctors won't accept, and you can't get neuropsychs or neurologists to accept that. So it goes all the way up and down that spectrum.
Right.
So the last category I want to start to dive into, and I have some questions. Because I, you So
eyes are crossed.
Liens. What's the difference between a lien and a credit? Because I think a lot of plaintiff attorneys out there will have a case where there's a workers' comp lien. What is the difference between a lien and a credit? What does that mean?
Short and simple. The lien is all the money they spent to the time the PI case settles. Okay. A credit is what the workers' comp is going to do an offset before they pay any benefits based on the net recovery to your client.
Can you tell me, like, I'm a child, what that means?
Right. Okay.
So, assume for the purposes this attorney who has comic books all over his office is a child. And explain it to me that way.
So let's say you have a $300,000 PI settlement, and we do a one-third, one-third, one-third split, where there's $100,000 in fees, $100,000 doctors, and $100,000 goes to your client. And workers' comp has a $50,000 lien at the time you settle. And let's just say, for argument's sake, you pay them the full $50,000. So now your client walks away with $50,000, and they have an open workers' comp case that's still ongoing. Mm-hmm. Workers' comp can then file a petition for credit, mm-hmm. get it approved by the judge for $50,000. And what it means is workers' comp doesn't have to pay any more benefits until your client has used up that $50,000.
So it's like a deductible of sorts.
So what I do, and it's, you know, it's quite a challenge, right? And so, you know, I have to show, there are two ways or several ways you can fight a credit in a workers' comp case. But if my client has health insurance, I go get your treatment through health insurance, then get an explanation of benefits printout for me. Because what the doctor charges and then what is paid is what I use to challenge the credit, okay? Or at least prove that he has spent $50,000.
Our credits... Are they, can you litigate that issue? Is that set in stone? Or, you know, if there's a $50,000 credit, is that?
It's more set in stone. It's more broad than the lien. You could challenge the lien. You can fight the itemizations on the lien. The credit is more broad. It even includes penalties and stuff for the attorneys.
Yeah. How does non-economic damages play into this? Because it sounds like the credits essentially use up all the money that your client gets.
That's correct.
Regardless of what the award is, yeah.
Yeah. So there is no account for pain and suffering. So it's just lumped together. And in Adam's example, if the client gets $50,000, right? And let's say the client had to have two shoulder surgeries. And clearly, you know, for two shoulder surgeries, that should just be all pain and suffering, right? Workers' comp could care less. They're like, oh, okay, well, we got our 50 in the civil case, but now we're going to make you spend $50,000. And my client's sitting there like, hey, this is for pain and suffering. But there is no provision right now that allows for that kind of a pain and suffering offset. However, in the work comp case, I do challenge those. And I can prove that $50,000 that they got doesn't even represent the value of their case. So a lot of times you guys are dealing with policy limits, right? Say it's a 300, 500 policy, like Adam was giving the example. And the case is probably $1 million case. Let's say it's a $2 million case, right? And they've had multiple surgeries. They need multiple additional surgeries. So in the work comp case, I would then challenge that credit and say, no, you can't take credit on that 50 because this case is actually worth much more. Then you have to save all of your life care plans, your, you know, all of your economic analysis, your, you know, vocational analysis, whatever it is that you have, I'm going to say, give them to me. What was your demand at mediation? Oh, it was $2
million. Then $10 million.
$10 million. At least $10. Well, there's nothing less at the Simon Group, right?
$1 million.
So then I can fight and challenge that credit. So there are ways, but that mountain is high.
And the easiest way to challenge it is if there's any employer negligence.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't take a lot because it's based on the percentage of what you think the case value was in the PI case. Yeah. So let's just say it was a $2 million case that you only had a $300,000 recovery on, right? And we have the $50,000 credit that we're talking about, the same facts. But let's just say you say that the employer was just 10% at fault. Well, they would be 10% at fault on a $2 million value, which means that they have to spend $200,000 before the credit kicks in. So it's like a reverse credit against the employer.
Love it. Right. That's why in the PI case, you know, I know sometimes, you know, there are some strategical issues and you don't want to prove up employer negligence. But in the work comp case, I love it right? Because any of that employer negligence is something I can use to argue. Yeah. You know, there's a difference between a lien and when someone comes in as a plaintiff in intervention.
That was my next question. Ooh. Tell me what a plaintiff in intervention is.
Wait, am I still treating you like a child?
Yeah, yes, of course. Yes. Don't be confused by the beard. Yeah, and the child and the wedding ring. I am, for all intents and purposes, a little boy. Somebody called me sir the other day, and I was like, "What are you talking?"
Oh, really?
Yeah, sir.
That's every day. Yeah. Okay, so with a lien, it's, you know, where the insurance company says, "Hey, Brandon, this is how much we spent. Go protect us." Okay, and so in the personal injury case, you're going to make sure that you're going to protect their lien, and then at the end of it all, you can deduct your attorney's fees, you know, based on the common fund, right? And you can then reduce the lien by a third or 40% or whatever it is you're charging your client. Now, if they hired their own insurance or their own attorney, then they're a plaintiff or they're a plaintiff in intervention, and you don't get that kind of leeway and deduction, right? They're represented.
Well, you don't get to reduce the lien, but yes. Let's make something very clear. The PI attorney, your fees and cost are always number one.
Yep.
Always number one in any scenario, even if it wipes out the entire settlement and workers' comp doesn't get any money back, it's number one. And workers' comp always says, oh, but we have the first right to a lien. We're the first lien. And your response should be, but I'm not a lien.
Yep.
This is my fees and my cost.
That's right.
We come first.
So I think we're getting out of time, but I have two big questions. And then we could wrap it up. So before we move on, just liens and credits. What happens? I've had a situation where we were in trial and the defendant, the third party tortfeasor that we were alleging, it was a slip and fall in the janitorial company we sued. They actually bought the workers' comp lien. How does that work? Mm-hmm. What is it? Are there Geraldine shaking or not in disapproval? Obviously, that might not be a good thing. And then my follow up is, what if you go to trial and waive past medical expenses? Is that, can you shaft them? How does it work?
I mean, you really shouldn't allow the workers' comp lien to be bought. If you're working with the workers' comp defense attorneys and their carrier, they shouldn't do that because that really sandbags the plaintiff. Okay. You can absolutely, there's a labor code provision that actually says you can settle around workers' comp and you can basically say, we're not asking for any damages that workers' comp has paid for. And it's basically just general damages. And the case law on it, I'm sure Travis can research it, says, you know, that they can't receive anything that wouldn't even be on a verdict form, right? So basically, in theory, what you would do is if you waived all the benefits paid for by workers' comp, the defense would have the burden of putting on their own case as a plaintiff, just like the employer would to get paid back their lien as a plaintiff in intervention. And they can't even put that evidence on. And if you don't ask for it, they don't get a reduction at the end of the case. And you just took out the value of that lien. Now, they get full credit. So if there's a $500,000 work comp lien and that's they pay $100,000 for it, and that evidence comes in and you get whatever your verdict is, they get to offset that entire verdict by $500,000.
Doesn't matter what they paid for it?
Doesn't matter what they paid for it. They get the full value.
So don't let them buy it.
Don't let them buy it.
And that's why when Adam was saying that if you have the opportunity to buy it, then you can buy it because then you don't get to, you know, have the defense go, well, we just bought it for pennies on the dollar, but they get to claim 100%.
So that's my last question. This is, well, this and then one more short question. Can you, as the plaintiff, buy the lien?
100%.
And what is the benefit of doing that?
Every dollar you save on the lien,
yes,
as long as there's no employer negligence, is double dipping. So if you buy a $500,000 lien for $100,000 and there's zero employer negligence in the case, your client just double dipped by that $400,000 that the That's defense right. would get to double dip, that they would get to reduce the verdict by.
Wow.
Can I just jump in about UM and UIM?
Very quickly. We're running out of time. And I have an important question to ask you specifically.
No, yes. I'm not going to answer.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't drinking last night.
That wasn't her.
So on UM and UIM, UM, even though they're not going to pay back the workers' comp lien, they get to take 100% credit on whatever
workers' comp has paid. So that applies to UIM as well. So you get ultra screwed if you have a UIM.
But if you go after it early, mm-hmm. workers' comp can't ask for that money back for mm-hmm. their lien.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So the very the last question, the most important question I have is, Geraldine, who is your favorite Anaheim Ducks player of all time and why?
Ooh, good question.
Why? That's so hard.
It's not that hard. Come on. There's only two.
Favorite?
Yeah. If you don't say Paul Kariya, get the hell out of here.
Paul Kariya. Yeah,
okay. I would have accepted
Timo
Solani.
Timo Solani.
Yeah, I would have accepted Timo Solani.
And I don't agree that Niedermeyer should have been inducted into their Hall of Fame.
You hear that, Anaheim Ducks?
Oh, sorry.
Actually, who was the goaltender that was on Tom Ferris' jury? Guy Hebert, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was on Tom Ferris' jury a couple
really?
Years ago. Yeah.
Didn't Tom Ferry have Axl Rose on his jury,
yes,
too?
Yes, he did. Yes.
Oh, no
he was
way.
An alternate. Yeah. I would love to spend a lot of time talking about Anaheim Ducks and obscure hockey. Actually, Tom Conroy would love that. But we're out of time, so thank you to the panel. Thanks for Geraldine
thanks for
and Adam for
us.
Coming.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening. Thank you to Adam and Geraldine again. Thank you, Travis and Grayson.
That was fun.
And remember, as Kevin O'Hara says, there's no sleep till justice.
No
I'm your host,
sleep
Brandon Simon.
Justice.
And my sign-out, Simon... out.
Mount nice. Up. It was a litigation fight. A fully packed room. Kev Dog is here to crush. Ready to entomb some defense MD. His opinion's all junk. He knows he can't hide. Scared to the bone. Just hit the west side of Hermosa Beach. Defense about to learn. Wrath of SLG. Send the Army report. Opinions all weak. All you insurance doc hacks are about to see. So I took the report and went right through it. I grabbed the mic and said, let's do this. You seen the MRIs and said nothing's up. Yet I know lying is how you make your bucks. This doc is a sleaze and also a perv. Straight face at the disc, never hit the nerve. Forget the treating docs, this classic trick. Paid to say the disc is normal and shouldn't be fixed. I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I need to expose this crooked doctor's wealth. Insurance every time, surely the next. Paid millions to lie about injuries of either sex. My client's diagnosed, doc's acting a clown. Says it's all a sprain and lose a few pounds. Claims no nerve compression when doc was around. Even though the pain radiates all the way down. Doc says it's in his head, some out-of-form sound. Even through the Mullinger theory down. This theory won't fly, let me contemplate. My client got the surgery and now it feels great. The pain went away, that's the ultimate goal. All Doc could do now was cry placebo. Now Doc's red and yelling, it's a tad bit late. Kev Dog and SLP had to regulate. Laid this expert down, let his mind explode. Now I'm in seek and destroy mode. Every other doctor in this case observed and said surgery decompressed the nerve. Now this doc is looking weak, and that's a known fact. He's sweating from his head down to his nutsack. Back up, cause it's on. Concession City to Kev Dog and SLG. Just like I thought, the trauma is what put my client in need of desperate help. Surgery worked and the defense was in need of something else. Degenerative disc, doc tried to sell. I said, ooh, I like your try. Pre-ax, did he have pain at any time? No evidence of that, it's going real swell. KC3927, eggshell.